Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, it was just last week that we were lamenting the fact that Republicans were probably going to lose a Senate seat in Maine, and it certainly looks like that's probably still the case based on the very early polling, since we don't know exactly who's in the race. But the best-case scenario there looks like an independent would win that seat. But there is good news on two other seats, one that we're hoping to hold and one that we're almost assuming we're going to pick up, but it's always good to get verification. First of all, in Massachusetts, Scott Brown, who's a Republican in Massachusetts, and if ever there's an endangered species combination, that should be it, especially with someone as well-funded as Elizabeth Warren running against him. But according to a whole smattering of polls, Brown is up anywhere from 5 to 9 points, and he's pretty much locked in right there at 49%, which means he's in not exactly the best position for an incumbent, but for an incumbent Republican in Massachusetts, he's doing great. And over in Nebraska, Bob Kerry, of course, decided after not deciding to run that he is going to run. So that means he actually has to move back to Nebraska from New York. So far, the people in Nebraska not very warm to that idea, losing to Attorney General John Bruning right now by 22 points, to State Treasurer Don Stenberg by 18 points, and State Senator Deb Fischer by 12 points. And in all of those polls, Kerry can't get past 34%. So got to like those numbers and what we're seeing up in Massachusetts.
Oh, what a magilla, Greg, when you have to move to the state you're running in. You know? Did they make Hillary Clinton do that? No. Yeah. It's conceivable those numbers will improve for Bob Kerry, but I don't even know if I would count on that. I mean, you would assume that most Nebraskans would know who he was. The issue seems to be really, as you said, he's been living in New York City for about 10 years, and the state has changed. Maybe they have fond memories of him in the Senate, but, you know, times change. I think it's also safe to say that Nebraska has become a heck of a lot more Republican since then, and he hasn't really done much to enhance his street cred as a conservative Democrat. So on that front, it's entirely possible that the big recruitment score of the Democrats in Nebraska might turn out to be a fizzle. As for Massachusetts, it is reassuring. I'm a little bit surprised by that. There are a lot of folks who kind of figured that this is the contraception controversy. That, you know, for all of the liberalism of Massachusetts, it is still a heavily Catholic state, a heavily Irish-American state. And there are probably quite a few folks there who are not completely, you know, whatever their personal views on contraception, they probably sense something bullying in the way the administration has handled the objections from the Catholic Church and all of this. So, good news, still a lot of road ahead, but I think it's kind of, you know, entirely conceivable that the entire mentality and attitude and confrontational indignation that Elizabeth Warren brings to basically her entire public life, that everything that makes her adored by the Daily Coast crowd may not play all that well in Massachusetts. And, you know, every couple of years I get reminded of this by folks who live up in the Bay State, that yes, it's a heavily Democratic state, and yes, by most standards, it's a liberal state, but it still has a bunch of independents, and it's not Berkeley, basically. It is, you know, it's the state of Tip O'Neill. It's an old, you know, formerly unionized, white working class, white ethnic, cultural state. And so it's entirely possible Elizabeth Warren's style may not mesh as well with as many Democrats in that state as they may think. So here's hoping, but I think this is definitely a good martini for today.
Yeah, it certainly is. And looks like Elizabeth Warren's not necessarily learning the lessons of Martha Coakley, and I'm perfectly content to have her not learn those lessons. So into martini number two now. Jim, we've talked about the president's lead from behind strategy when it comes to foreign policy. The idea that apparently he doesn't think America is exceptional. He says it's exceptional in the way that all other nations think they're exceptional. So we're all cut from the same cloth, according to this administration. And that was put on display once again yesterday before the Senate Armed Services Committee, where under questioning from Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, who we've previously given credit to in a couple of different ways in recent months, definitely lost some points with us. When asked about what the U.S. military would be doing in future military actions, say in Syria, here's what Panetta had to say, first of all.
When it comes to the kind of military action where we want to build a coalition and work with our international partners, then obviously we would like to have some kind of legal basis on which to do it, as we did in Libya.
Sessions pounced on that, saying that, yeah, you went to Libya and you violated the War Powers Act, never asking for congressional approval. So what would you do if, say, I don't know, you wanted to impose a no-fly zone over Syria?
Our goal would be to seek international permission, and we would come to the Congress and inform you and determine how best to approach this, whether or not we would want to get permission from the Congress. I think those are issues we would have to discuss as we decide what to do here.
Jim, to his credit, Sessions did a great job of pointing out to Panetta that NATO and the UN don't count as the rule of law in the United States, that we have a constitution for those sorts of things, and Congress has the power to declare war and, of course, pass use of force resolutions, which we've done in the past. And so, once again, this administration just trying to play nice with others. America's not unique or special in the world, and they just bow at the feet of the UN and other international organizations rather than respecting their own sovereignty. Kind of makes you want to puke.
Yeah, Panetta is conflating two doctrines here. And the first is that no Congress will ever object to a president taking military action in a genuine emergency circumstance. You know, if one of those things where if we find out that some country is about to launch an attack on us and there's no time to go to Congress and get a congressional authorization of force, no problem. You know, it's one of those things, look, in emergency where lives are at stake, time is of the essence, no Congress is ever going to give a president grief over that kind of decision making. But I just laid out a pretty, you know, specific set of circumstances, i.e. emergency, lives at stake, no time available to send it to Congress and have a vote and all that kind of sort of thing. In this circumstance, as much as I am a happy to see Bashar Assad's day get ruined, as much as I think what the Syrian regime is brutal and ruthless and you know, utterly immoral and worth attempting to stop, I think a lot of Americans are very wary about using military force in Syria, and I think they have good reasons to. If this is really worth doing, it is worth taking to Congress. If this is really worth, you know, have a significant U.S. national security interest, and Lord knows we have enough reasons to have objections to the Assad regime, I think for obvious reasons, based on our experiences in Egypt and based on our experiences in Libya, a lot of Americans are looking at Syria and wondering, huh, would the replacement be that much better for us? You know, and there's obviously been reports of Al-Qaeda trying to stir up trouble in Syria and use this as a motivating force, as a recruitment force in there. Look, this is a messy, complicated issue, which is all the more reason that it should be debated with by all of our leaders and not just be made by Barack Obama and Leon Panetta or, you know, Susan Rice or the UN, whoever at the UN says. It's kind of a fascinating lack of trust in Congress and in the people. And I'm just kind of marveling that they went through this. As we've mentioned, you know, Leon Panetta seems like kind of the sane one in this administration, both when he was running CIA and now that he's at the Pentagon. It's really disappointing to hear him say that he really doesn't believe Congress should have any say, you know, on whether the U.S. should use military force in Syria, barring some sort of emergency thing. By the way, if Syria were to try to attempt to take American hostages or something like that, hey, you know, we'd all be all for that. I'm just marveling. I'm just infuriated. And you know, it's Leon, we expected more of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a split personality, this administration, just groveling on the international stage and then just completely arrogant towards Congress and saying, if we decide to do anything, we'll let you know. On to Martini number three now, Jim. And, of course, the big story for liberals in the past couple of weeks has been the horrific treatment of Georgetown Law School student Sandra Fluke after admitting that she needs to spend $3,000 on contraception, but her personal decisions ought to be funded by others than herself. And so Rush Limbaugh was among those who spoke out on this and called her, well, let's just say he called her promiscuous in a number of ways. And so there was this huge backlash. He apologized. Nonetheless, dozens of advertisers reportedly have now abandoned him and just for saying those words, which are arable, by the way. And so he is.
We're just too classy to do so.
We are. But I think most people know what they are if they listen to us. Yeah. Meanwhile, Bill Maher, of course, over on HBO, has referred to Sarah Palin in a number of extremely disparaging ways, including one word which is probably the worst possible word you could utter. And the Obama administration, which is just horrified at Sandra Fluke's treatment by Rush Limbaugh. David Axelrod will soon be appearing on HBO. Was it Real Time with Bill Maher, I think is the name of the show. So apparently it's very, very horrifying one way. But the other way, no big deal. It's just a comedian talking.
Bill Maher uses at least two words that you can't believe that weren't among the seven deadly words. of George Carlin's famous routine. We're talking about the T word and the C word, and we'll let people fill in the blanks there. My reaction to this, because this is not just what Bill Maher has been doing. I mean, Bill Maher also is hosting a fundraiser for the Alabama Democratic Party later this month. And by the way, I can't think of a bigger draw in Alabama than Bill Maher. What better way to for Alabama Democrats to say, hey, we understand the culture and nature of this state than to bring in this Hollywood guy? So we have, you know, Democratic congresswoman who, you know, yesterday up on Capitol Hill were asked, you know, you've denounced Rush Limbaugh. Do you think, you know, Bill Maher deserves the same denunciation for using these words? And they refused to answer the question, like, repeatedly, just like storming away and refusing to believe there's any equivalent there. And then, of course, you get into this circumstance with Axelrod, really being, you know, who's denounced Republicans for being afraid to criticize Rush Limbaugh, and who's now going to come on and, you know, play snuggle bunnies with Bill Maher. Now, Greg, I don't know about you. I could live with a culture that was more respectful. If people want to say, Jim, we want you to watch your language. We want everything to be at least as mild-mannered and respectful and even-keeled as the tone on Three Martini Lunch and not when you get unhinged with, say, Ed Morrissey every now and then or something, you know, then that'd be fine. If they also said, look, you know what? The First Amendment trumps everything. Anybody can say whatever they want. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but, you know, words will never hurt me. Everything's, you know, politics is not beanbag. Welcome to the arena. You know, it's all fair game. Fine. I could go with either one of those. What we have is one in which we demand respect in one direction of one party, but we don't expect, you know, respect in the other direction. And it's appalling, and it just kind of shows. I'm not really sure that this big controversy is working for the Democrats the way they think it is, because I think that the apolitical folks, the folks who don't pay that much attention to this, look, they know that what Rush Limbaugh said was terrible and he should never have said it, but they see all this other stuff going on here and they kind of mark, but wait a minute, you know, nobody really ever complains. You very rarely hear a Republican saying when a Democrat is criticized, how dare you criticize her in that tone? And you very rarely see a Democrat saying when a Republican is criticized, how dare you, you know, say that in that tone? Probably one of the few great exceptions of this is Kirsten Powers, who's on Fox News periodically and wrote an item on the Daily Beast. She's a Democratic consultant who has laid out why her party, you know, much to her frustration, has enormous double standard on this. I'd be happy either way. I just want our culture to pick one instead of having this enormous double standard. And, you know, the idea that things are only offensive when Republicans say them, Democrats can say the same or far worse. And, you know, nobody bats an eyelash.
Be curious to see what Kirsten Powers' inbox looked like from the tolerant left after she called him to task on that. My guess is it's not very pretty. But
warm and fuzzy, my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. The fact that she's on Fox has probably already made her a pariah. But, Jim, very interesting. We'll have more to say tomorrow, of course. Have a great day till then.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.